Welcome to the Chicago Booth podcast series. This broadcast features David Booth, MBA 1971, whose gift led to the naming of the school in his honor, and faculty member Eugene Fama, whose theories of modern finance greatly influenced Mr. Booth. The discussion, moderated by Dean Edward Snyder, looks at Mr. Booth's co-founding of Dimensional Fund Advisors, which pioneered small-cap investing, as well as the continuing contribution Professor Fama and his research have made to the firm. The event was part of the school's Distinguished Speaker Series.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to today's Distinguished Speaker Series, co-organized by the Chicago Booth Graduate Business Council. I think I speak for everyone when I say that we're very excited to hear from some of our university's most prominent graduates, one of whom will be moderating today's discussion. Dean Ted Snyder's success in building the Chicago Booth brand is widely recognized and acknowledged. During his nine-year tenure as dean of our business school, he has left an indelible mark on this institution's physical infrastructure, its curriculum, and of course, its endowment. But as a student who has had the privilege of talking to Dean Snyder on a number of occasions, I think his greatest achievement is something else altogether. One of the first things I remember Dean Snyder saying is how important it is for business students to be treated not like customers, but like collaborators. I think this idea has been critical throughout the school's history and has been instrumental in fostering the kinds of relationships like the one we are here today to learn more about. Dean Snyder embodies the University of Chicago tradition, and I cannot think of a better moderator for today's event. I give you Dean Snyder.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. It's really good to see everyone here. I'm going to be brief. To my left is David Booth. To his left. is Gene Fama. So let's get going. So I have some substantive questions, but there's a great story associated with how David Booth got to the University of Chicago. He was in a somewhat precarious position, about to get drafted. And then somebody said, well, let me take another look at your file.
Yeah, so the chief medical officer, he had already been drafted, actually. I ran into the chief medical officer at the induction center later on in the afternoon. He said, what were you going to do if I hadn't drafted you? I said, well, I was going to go to the University of Chicago, study finance. He said, let me look at your file one more time. He said, I've decided to reject you for a year. And that's how I got out of the Army.
And then, with whom was your first class? Yep. So, as they say, the rest is history.
Wait, did you have the prerequisites?
Sorry, what?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I wanted to try to do was maybe disabuse you to the extent that you have the view that, well, this guy David Booth just happened to be the guy in the right place at the right time. Obviously, he had that stroke of luck of having, oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks, Jessica. Of getting that guy to look at his file again, showing up at Chicago. Modern finance was being developed by Gene and others. But, you know, there were a lot of people in the classroom who, in principle, could have taken the ideas coming out of Chicago and built up a firm like Dimensional. So when I announced the gift that named the school in November 2008, one of the things I said about David Booth was that not only is he a great finance thinker, he's a great entrepreneur and a great marketer. So let me just explore those other two dimensions about David, and then we'll get into some current finance research. And then hopefully we'll, and I'm sure we'll have time for some dialogue with you. Marketing. Let's talk about marketing. One of the aspects that a lot of people who do marketing now think of is, well, you got to have people downstream own the brand. take pride in the brand. How do you do that at Dimension?
Well, we have two types of clients at Dimensional. When we first started, what we had as clients were what you would think of as large institutional clients, defined benefit plans, defined contribution plans and so forth, insurance companies. And then, kind of by sheer luck, without much foresight, we started getting into working with financial advisors. Financial advisors covers a wide range of people these days. I mean, every broker calls themselves a financial advisor, I guess. But we work with a particular subset, which are fee-only financial advisors. You know, most financial services are still distributed, I think, through brokerage. But there are the fastest growing area of financial services industry, and is the fee only advisor. You might think of it as a CPA or somebody on his own just does it, invests for a client and charges them a cash fee. The reason that that's important is, even though a lot of my best friends are brokers, the incentives are not aligned with a client. A broker only gets to eat what he kills. The fee-only people get paid the same regardless of who you trade with or if you trade at all. I've never seen a study, but I think we can all guess that accounts managed by brokers, the turnover rate of in portfolios is considerably higher than with fee-only advisors.
It's because they get so many hot ideas.
So many hot ideas. And so little time. So we started working this very small part of the segment of the investment business, the fee-only advisor network. And indirectly, this gives us access to the individual marketplace, but we don't sell directly to individuals. And there's some good marketing reasons for that. It's too expensive. But working with this fee-only advisor, we developed a very, you might think of it, information superhighway, innovative distribution channel. So what we did was we said, look, we understand individuals are in and out of markets all the time, and all that does is incur costs for everybody else in your funds. And we had developed some mutual funds. And we said, we can't have that behavior, So we started screening these advisors very carefully. We said, look, if we see that your clients are in and out of the funds a lot, then we'll just shut you down. We won't give you access to the funds anymore. Today, the way we sell actually that market is we have no direct selling effort. We wait for them to call us, and then we screen them over the phone. And then if they seem sensible, we invite them at their own expense to a two-day seminar, at the end of which then we have them give us a business plan as how they plan on using us. And if we like what we see, then we give them access to the funds. Otherwise, we reject them, and we end up rejecting more than we take.
So this is restricted distribution. How many independent advisors now are able to represent your products?
It's about 1,700 firms, and so it's probably 5,000 or 6,000 advisors, give or take a bit.
And do you think that they really understand? I'm sure there's a distribution of capabilities there, but as I said, there. I think today the hot marketing ideas is you want those people to represent you well, and do you think you're getting that out of them?
Slight correction. We don't ask them to represent us. We just say, look, if what we do works for you, that's great. But if you can find any fund anywhere else that serves your needs better, you got to use that. We don't expect you to, use a fund just because it's us. So they're very the relationship is very informal, and they use us because they want to. One of the things is
so would they tend to be believers in efficient markets more so than the average?
More so than the average, yeah. But that's not saying much. But it is about values. One of the great things about the business school is a set of values that the people here have about economics and finance and, you know, the principle. And basically what we do is we say, here's a set of values out there that we believe in very strongly. If that works for you, then we'd love to have, work with you. If it doesn't work with you, fine. You know, but we'll keep your name on file, and probably about 10 or 15 years, you'll give us a call back, you know. I think we have a tendency to get an older crowd, the people that have tried everything else first and failed, then they see that, maybe some of these ideas are useful.
And Gene, from your perspective as somebody who was involved in the firm from the beginning, what did you think of the marketing efforts by David?
Well, he left out, he glossed over what I think is important in getting them to project the image down the line. These seminars that he talked about, Ken Talks, I Talk, several other people.
Ken French.
Yeah, Ken French Talks, I Talk. And they get a heavy dose of what we call our three-factor model and what that implies for asset allocation.
You give them a quiz?
We don't give a quiz, but we do it again and again. So they get pretty articulate after a while in the dimensional philosophy about asset allocation. And they're pretty good. So, and they're pretty much up on our bond philosophy as well. But there's a lot of education that goes on that kind of marries them to dimensional a little at a time. And they get a lot of other services from the company. We try to fill in stuff that they don't unable to provide for themselves, especially the smaller ones. So there's a lot of back and forth. How many regional directors are there that service the financial advisors?
Well, we service kind of a team effort. We have about 30 or so, but then they have a team. Each of them has a team of three or four people.
Yeah, so. But they're basically continuously talking to these advisors. We have a website with the Farmer French forum on there and lots of other stuff written, expressing opinions and position papers on basically everything.
We try to make it so efficient that you would think that if you looked at the website of one of these advisors, you'd think Gene and Ken work directly with these advisors.
Looking over their shoulder.
On the shoulder, yeah, doing a good job. So Gene and Ken have been extremely helpful.
So hopefully that gives you a feel for, you know, it's not just building up a track record and then the money comes in.
But and if you look at our advisors, they fill out questionnaires. They buy our story, say 70%. So they're about 30% active and 70% passive. That compares to the industry as a whole, which is 80-20, active versus passive.
The other way.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
No, 80-20, active versus passive.
Okay, so that's a little bit about the marketing side. Let me talk about the, you know, David's entrepreneurial side. Obviously, he built up this firm, and he had a lot of help. I know he'll say that, so I'll just get that out of the way. But I think a lot of you are interested in entrepreneurship, but as many of you know, it's our second most important concentration, right after finance. And we were talking about it earlier. There comes a phase with a lot of successful, mature entrepreneurial firms when you have to go to the, quote, next level. And how do you do that? Well, in December 2002, Dimensional had $34 billion assets under management. Okay? Most of that money was U.S. equities. I believe I'm right, 17% were international.
Yeah, and half of the money is really U.S. small cap equities, so just very concentrated in the U.S. small cap.
Okay, so 17% non-U.S. equities, $34 billion asset under management, that's December 2002. We're now 7.5 years later, very different picture. Depending on what's happened the last few days, assets under management, $170 billion or so. And I think international would be more like 44%, maybe 45%.
Yeah.
And small is a much smaller fraction.
And right? Small has gotten smaller.
Small is down to 16% of total assets.
Right.
So, I mean, this is a really dramatic change in the company. So as you're leading the company going into 2003, I assume you had to do something to make that happen.
Yeah, there was actually kind of several things came together. Encouragement of Gene, the outside board, said, you know, it's time to do things a little differently. So we did a funny thing. We said, look, we'd never had any particular objective in mind other than survival. But we said, you know, over the next 15 years, we're going to grow to $500 billion under management. And so then we backed up from that and said, look, if you're going to go to $500 billion under management over a 15-year period, could you take the money even if, you know, if people were willing to give it to you? And we said, no, you couldn't, because half our money was in U.S. small cap. We couldn't manage $250 billion worth of U.S. small cap. So we set out you know, on a transition path. Until that time, it was a fork in the road, really. You know, we'd managed kind of like being a typical entrepreneurial firm, managed around the water cooler and without much structure. And so it's been, I'd say it's just right now, it's been that whole time, it's been segueing from the entrepreneurial shop to, let's call it, professionally run shop.
So one thing you did was you set a goal, a very, as they say, audacious goal, $500 billion by 2018.
Yep.
And, you know, it sounds a little arbitrary. It's just audacious, though. I mean, you're at $34 billion or $32 billion. Yeah, I guess it's $34 and
whatever.
Yeah, that requires a high rate of speed.
Yeah, what was happening was that, you know, I think a lot of people that take on entrepreneurial studies probably would like to think that they can run this great little firm and they'll do things totally differently than all the terrible places they ever worked. And that kind of works for a while, but eventually you have to choose. Do you want to grow or do you want to be this small little entrepreneurial firm? And we chose to grow. And what we found was is that people weren't anticipating growth. We were always treating it as a random event or something. So I said, look, I'll take the responsibility. We're going to go to $500 billion. Plan for it. If we don't get there, that's fine. And by the way, parenthetically, that's just what we want to plan for. We don't have to get there. I mean, we're very competitive, and we want to be as big as we should be. But we'll be fine. We'll be as big as we're meant to be. Because we don't have any control over how many people actually believe this stuff. You know, we're part of this diaspora of Chicago-trained people that are spreading the word about market efficiency. And, you know, there's still plenty of time. I mean, you know, I've been doing it for 39 years now.
They're more than you and I? They're more than you and I?
Let me go to the first part of that. Because I understand you let people know that, okay, you acknowledge that you didn't control the destiny in the full sense of the, you know, goal. But I think this is a really interesting leadership lesson. David said to people, plan on it. Plan on doing your part. Okay. So if I'm on David's team, it's my job to plan on building the capability to get to $500 billion. That's a really important message if I'm on his team. And he's saying, okay, if we don't get there, I don't want you to be the person to be the bottleneck. And he's also sort of taking me off the hook and saying, we may not get there, but you need to plan on it. You need to take actions as if we are going to get there, which I think is a really interesting thing for a leader to do, especially, as I said, at that critical phase of a mature entrepreneurial firm trying to go, you know, from, okay, we're lucky to keep growing and surviving, to boom.
Yeah, that's a very interesting part of business I never thought about. Actually, there are a lot of parts of business I never thought about until being in the middle of it. But this segue, I can understand entrepreneurial studies, then I can understand regular management, but how do you get from there to here is something we've just lived through, and it seems like that's worth at least a chapter in an entrepreneurial book.
Because a lot of people use the right words. I mean, you go from a very kind of casual style to a professionalized style. I call it the professionalization of the company. And it's at every level. The thing that concerned me most all along, from when it became clear we were going to survive, I mean, that was the first issue, was, you know, how are we going to make sure that we deliver the products that we're promising to deliver? And as you get bigger and have more money under management, that gets to be a more and more serious problem. So you need all kinds of internal auditing procedures and ways of making sure and explaining why your portfolios aren't exactly the way they're supposed to be, and how fast are you moving towards the target? Are you appropriately balancing transactions costs against the potential gain? So the whole investment process became much more professionalized, much more checking involved, much more oversight involved in it, and then management. And along the way, there were people that had been with us from the beginning that either didn't want to or couldn't take their jobs forward to the next level, and he had to replace them, basically.
And I assume I was going to get to that. Was my next point. I assume there were other people who couldn't make the transition.
There were several people.
Water cooler, okay, we're poking along, to let's go.
Yeah,
and you had to make the call.
Yeah, what I would say is that, you know, personally, I want you to stay, but Gene said that.
Now we know who's the tough guy. Okay. Yeah.
No, in most cases it's.
What's your view on that?
Well, it's fine. It's you know, one of the things that Gene brings up from time to time, which hopefully is the case, is we try to emulate Chicago in that we want to be a place where people can debate ideas and do it very rigorously and have differences of opinion, but without taking things personally to the next step. And if you give people feedback, like here's what we need as a in this function, and it doesn't look like you're the kind of person that can fit that, mm-hmm. It's amazing how often the people will agree with you. We just had a senior person leave this spring, talked to her, and said, you know, this is what we need. And she goes, yeah, I agree, that's what you need, and that's what you hired me for, but that's not what I want to do. So she left on good terms.
And you're still having fun.
Actually, I'll be honest, I don't usually. So don't anybody tell this. But,
no, you forget this after you hear it.
Yeah. No, I remember I forgot. There was actually a couple of points in time. What I realized early on was you got to decide at some point, either you want to do what you think everybody expects you to do, or you want to do what you want to do. And I learned, I have this view, I this is probably an entrepreneurial firm, it's the only place it works. But I tell people, everybody in the firm, I'm worried about me. I keep changing my job around, so it's fun for me. I guess, you know, you interviewed Jack Welch. I think he's really good about talking about winning. It's kind of a version of winning.
Yep.
And I tell people in the firm, everybody deserves to be a winner. And it may not be at our firm, but you ought to figure out what's important to you and figure out how to be a winner. That's what a big part of life is about. So yeah, I'm having fun. You know, that's the part of the downside of being successful is you take away all your excuses for not being happy. I wake up in the morning and go, if I don't feel happy, I go, geez, whose fault is that?
Yeah, well, we spelled your name right. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not sure what else we can do. Anyways, you know, I think most people trade places with you. All right, let's talk about, you know, I think, Gene, most people would probably view your role as you take ideas that you have developed and push them into Dimensional. And on the other hand, there's got to be feedback mechanisms. I mean, you've also watched those ideas, you know, hit the real world. What about stuff going the other way?
Coming back from business to research, that's a tough one, because I've never thought research is done in a very planned way. It just kind of happens and evolves on its own, and you're sucking stuff in from the environment all around you. And I know at points in time, people have said to me, well, after I've given talks, you know, Q&A, somebody will say something. And it may even be a dumb question, but it causes me to think about something, and then it affects something that I'm also working on. So there is feedback back and forth. And we are a business school. I mean, sometimes my colleagues tend to forget that, but we are a business school, and the research we do should have some relevance for our constituents, which are our students, our alumni, and the faculty.
So I
think that it's very valuable to be exposed to a company, especially one like this one, which doesn't put a lot of big demands on my time.
So as you've seen ideas implemented at Dimensional and you've looked at performance,
yeah,
have you seen things that you look at and sort of go, this just doesn't square with my expectations?
Well, what the problem, so let's go back to the beginning. David's initial idea was, let's start a small stock funds, and the business was originally oriented towards that because he had been selling, and he thought institutions weren't exposed at all to small stock. Their portfolios were basically devoid of small stocks. And he came to me when he started the company, and I said, oh, wow, I just had a student that did a thesis on that topic, and it basically said small stocks historically have had higher returns than big stocks. So that's a little bit of a marketing angle. But actually, he was prepared with the small stock line before that. But the big, at that time, academics were poo-pooing the whole notion that small stocks had higher returns, because they said you couldn't actually do that. That if you went to trade these things, the trading costs would wipe out the apparent benefits of having a small stock portfolio. So that was, there was some uncertainty about whether or not that was true when they started the portfolio. So that involved the decision that, I think that was part of the decision, that they wouldn't actually index to anything. They would trade slowly towards things and be very aware of trading costs. Always try to be on the bid side of the market rather than the ask side of the market, because the bid ask spreads can be very large in this end of the market. And I mean, we could talk forever on it, but a passive investor has an advantage that they can basically on the buy side act a little bit like a market maker, and that turned out to be true. So measurements of our trading costs turned out to be wildly below anything the academics had ever estimated. And it didn't look like it was any more difficult to deliver the small stock portfolios than it was to deliver the big stock portfolios, except that you couldn't index. That would kill you if you really tried to index.
And explain that last part. Why couldn't you index? Because that
requires fast trading,
yeah,
to match the index. And that's a killer among small stocks.
Then you become a robot and you head into the
You're on the ass side of the market, yeah, at that point.
Okay. Let's go to the core, which may be on everybody's mind, which is efficient market issues. And see, how do I best get into this?
I think you're getting yourself into trouble.
No.
Is it a touchy subject?
No, it's not a touchy subject. let's go to your paper, Gene, that's forthcoming. Is it the JFE that's coming?
JF, right. Journal of Finance.
Yeah, okay, excuse me. Journal of Finance. Gene and Ken French have a paper on the performance of mutual funds. And the first thing is that long-run performance of mutual funds. First thing is that mutual funds, in the aggregate, roughly hold the market.
Active mutual funds.
Active mutual funds, thank you. Mm. So it's a pretty good way to get at the issue of whether active traders can, at least the way I interpret it, whether they can do better. And if you look at the results and you say, well, these active mutual funds basically hold the market, and Gene has finally beat this into me, then even before fees, if they basically hold the market, that means they're going to get average returns. Is that correct?
That's correct, but superficial.
I told you you're going
to be take the first part of that. The second part of that is after fees, they're negative.
Right.
That's also correct and superficial.
No,
right?
that's for the industry as a whole.
Yeah, that's the industry as a whole.
That's not the interesting part.
Okay.
So the people that have taken my course have been deluged with this stuff.
This
so
was
I'll
prefatory,
bore
so okay.
I'll bore them. So the issue is, it's easy to judge the aggregate, and that's well known that mutual funds in aggregate basically hold the market, and so you get the returns. The after-cost returns are basically depend on what fees and expenses they generate. So that's a losing game. But the more interesting game is to take the whole cross-section of funds and say, can you identify whether there are true winners and losers in that population? And the challenge is that when you have a cross-section of funds that are, these are all actively managed funds, so they're not fully diversified, there's going to be a big range of outcomes due solely to chance. In other words, they have no talent, but in fact, there's a big range of outcomes produced simply because they're either lucky or unlucky. And the non-superficial part of this paper is constructing a simulation approach that basically allows you to say, what would the world look like if there were no skill out there, but each fund was basically identical to the way it looked historically? And so what that involves is you basically wipe out all evidence of alpha in their funds and the funds' returns, and then you do lots of bootstrap simulations, 10,000 of them, to generate a big cross-section distribution of outcomes. And it's amazingly dispersed. So and then what you do is you compare that cross-section of outcomes to the actual cross-section of outcomes to judge whether the actual looks different, better, or worse than you would expect by chance. So if you look after costs, if you look at fund returns after costs, they're awful. 97% of the distribution is below what you would expect by chance if they had enough skill to cover their costs. So it's clear that most of them do not have enough skill to cover their costs. The top 3% are just about as good as you would expect if they had enough skill to cover their costs. Now, this is the non-intuitive part. So let's look at the distribution. So you take the 90th percentile, the t-statistic for the alpha at the 90th percentile. We're looking at the history of funds over their entire lifetimes. So the average lifetime is like 11 years for the fund in the sample. So the people that are way out in the right tail have had good returns on average for 11 years. And the alpha at the 90th percentile works out to about 3.5% a year. So those funds, and the funds above that naturally are better, so those funds blew the lights out as far as investors are concerned, but the reality is they're not as good as you would expect by chance. Which means that going forward, your expected value is that at the 90th percentile, they're losers. You're actually going to do worse than buying a passive index fund at the 90th percentile. If you buy the portfolio of the top 3%, you expect to do about as well as buying a passive portfolio, even though that top 3% was incredibly good. I mean, the books would be written about every one of those managers as if they came down on a cloud from heaven and were just totally knowledgeable about investing. And they're about as good as you would expect by chance if they just had enough skill to cover their costs. In other words, they generate alphas before costs of approximately 1%. So now, the historical alphas, though, were in the order of 6%. Truly incredible, over the whole period of their lives. So somebody will surely say to you at some point, look, here's a manager that did it for 20 years in a row. Well, and he did it, and he beat it by 4% a year. Great. But probably luck. If I put him in the whole distribution, he looks good, he smells good, he tastes good, but that's based on the past candy bar. The candy bar going forward is probably going to look worse than that of a passive manager. Now, that's the non-intuitive part of it. That's the difficult to swallow part of it. But it's just not appreciating what kinds of ranges of what kinds of outcomes can possibly be due to chance. Now, the world looks a lot better if you give them back their costs. So if you give them back, of course, that's irrelevant for an investor, but because an investor eats the costs. If you give them back their costs, then basically the right tail beyond the 90th percentile and the left tail look like there are really bad managers in the left tail and there are really good managers in the right tail, and they just about balance each other off. So that when you, as Ted said, when you put them all together, you get the market portfolio and you get a zero alpha before cost and then a negative alpha after cost. So people would say, golly, I can think about how a manager can be really good, skilled, but what's an unskilled manager? Well, here's the reality. You can't have a skilled manager without unskilled managers because you can't win the game against the passive manager. A passive manager buys the index, and if you look at the market portfolio of passive managers, they deliver the passive return. The active managers aren't gaining from them. They deliver the active return, and the low-fee ones deliver it with very low fees. So there's something that Bill Sharpe calls the arithmetic of active management. Before costs, alpha has to average to zero across active managers. So if there are some that are really skilled, they have to be balanced by some that are really unskilled. And when you layer on top of that the effects of chance, now you're really in the dark. Because lots of the guys in the left tail are there because they're unlucky. Some are there because they're unskilled. Lots of the unskilled ones end up in the right tail simply because they're lucky. And all of this I've been saying now almost 50 years. And 20% of the money is managed passively.
So why is that?
Why
is it that you two still face this information gap between what you know, what your research shows, what Dimensional's performance proves, and the persistence of active management? And one way to think about it is that there are, new people who just continually camp on the other side of that information gap, and they need to be proven wrong. And you mentioned it, David, that some of the older advisors tend to flock your way eventually. But how do you explain the persistence of, and not only the persistence, the real dominance of the active management in terms of an equilibrium phenomenon?
Well, it's very difficult. I would have thought that I would have had more than 20% at this point. 20% just mutual funds. The rest of the whole investment universe is all active. So the total fraction is much lower than 20%. Part of it, I think, is people don't understand.
So if I could just pick up on that, so what do you think the percent of real passive is?
Oh, I don't know. When you add up hedge funds and private equity and all of that, I don't know. Lubos, do you have any idea about what that number would be? I have no idea. Yeah. I have no idea.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, I think to some extent they don't understand this chance result. So, for example, Morningstar is ranking mutual funds all the time. But they don't say, oh, by the way, most of this is probably due to chance.
Yeah.
Because then their business doesn't look that great.
I think there are a couple of things. One is nobody, maybe Gene was an exception, but I don't think anybody's born with the intuition of market efficiency. I mean, if you look at stock market returns or charts, most people kind of see patterns, just intuitively. And the idea that professional money managers are worth the cost is something I think is learned. I don't think you get there. You're born with it. Then you add in a little dollop of overconfidence. That's where behavioral finance comes in help. Is this helpful?
Look at how many of our faculty members are running around using the B word.
What's the B word? Just to
bubbles.
Bubbles. Oh, okay.
I thought you were going to say a different B word.
No, that's the one. That's okay. That's a bad swear in my lexicon.
Okay. Okay.
And I think here's kind of a subtle point, but I think it plays on it as well, which is at some level there have to be times when somebody has some insight that's actually valuable. The right. Idea that there's never any insights, and that's not so there has to be, in some sense, the market can't be efficient in at every instant in time for all people. But what his research says is you can't identify them. And, if you could identify them, simple intuition tells you, why would these people share their money with you?
Right. That's the more powerful argument. The skill is a human capital. That's part of the marginal product of human capital. You don't expect that to go back to investors. It goes to the human capital. So the managers should figure out, if they are skilled, how to, in fact, profit from the skill so that investors just get normal risk-adjusted returns. That's something I know you do know. I mean, that's your area, mine.
Is that, David, what you often say, your approach is that the working assumption is that markets are efficient. Basically what you're...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what you have to do. I mean, you have to behave as though markets are efficient. That's the only reasonable conclusion, I think. Nevertheless, even us efficient market buffs, I mean, if somebody has superior insight, I know it's not me. But I always have my hunches. I mean, people ask me all the time, where do you think the market's going? And, sometimes I tell people to get at a cocktail party, just get them off your back or something. But I don't tell them where the market's going. I tell them where I think it's going. But I look back later on, and I think I'm wrong at least half of the time, So.
Well, lots of these students will go out into the active management business. Yeah. And I always ask myself, where did they learn that? Who among our faculty taught them to pick stocks? I don't know anybody that I would give my money to in our faculty and allow them to pick stocks.
That's really the tragedy, in that most of the students go through here and study efficient markets, observing that learning that one orangutan in 1,000 can beat the market 10 years in a row just by throwing darts.
It's more than that, actually.
They think they're that, 90% of the people think they're that one orangutan in 1,000,
Well, put it more practically, what are their chances of getting a job if they say they believe markets are efficient?
It's a big option value if you happen to be that orangutan.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to figure this out myself. But, Gene, go back to your research and I think I've asked you this once before, and I don't mind telling you, I didn't understand your answer before. Why do you say that you can't tell whether the result, given the results that you find, you can't distinguish the lucky ones from the skilled ones?
Okay.
As opposed to, why isn't it also a potential hypothesis that there are no skilled ones at all?
Oh, that's the null hypothesis, is that there are no skilled ones.
And
That's the way you
set. Do you have a
That's the way you set up the simulations. Yes, indeed. That's the whole setting up that test was the tough part of it.
And given that the results don't, do you reject that hypothesis?
Yeah, you reject. So if I take before costs, you can cleanly reject it. So before costs, you can cleanly.
And for an investor, that's what's critical.
No. After costs are critical.
Oh, I'm sorry. After.
Yeah,
costs.
That's
right. After
understandably
costs.
Confusing, yeah. Right? So in terms of returns to investors, it's very difficult. Well, in terms of returns to investors, no. It's easy to say that most of the population is unskilled. And it's very easy to say most of the population has insufficient skill to cover costs. Sure. Now, when you give them back all their costs, so that's what we mean by before costs, you give them back all their costs, then the distribution looks very symmetric around zero. The alpha distribution looks very symmetric around zero. And the both tails are fatter than you would expect, given by chance, given the way we simulate the chance outcomes.
And that's why you said there's some really good ones
and some really bad ones, right. But
some.
Yeah, but you can't point to the tails and say that the really good ones are in the right tail. On average, they are. Typically, they are. And the really bad ones are in the left tail. Typically, they are. But luck is also being thrown in.
They're mixed in with the lucky ones.
Right. So mixed in with the
luck. And these are all based on lookbacks, too. I mean,
this is over the whole period of their lives.
Okay.
Well, since 1983. That's about as far back as good, reliable data go.
Do you want to talk about Greece at all?
Greece?
Yeah. This is current events.
Yeah, okay. The worst, I don't know why markets went up yesterday, but I suppose they must have had a reason. Seems
to me.
Well,
they went down today, right?
Did they?
Big time. Not big time. 3 or 4%?
No, it's in Europe. It closed down just a tweak in the U.S.
Well, I think the S&P was down more, but yeah, it was a tweak.
Yeah, 30 basis points or so, I think.
Okay.
Well, there's a clear message now that Greece doesn't have to be as, they don't have to cut their budget so much that the rest of them, rest of the EU will bail them out. Now, the reason that frightens me, I don't really, the euro could fall apart. I mean, I think that would be to the detriment of Europe, and I don't see the big deal in letting Greece go under. Greece going under is like Rhode Island going under for the U.S. But, you know, the response.
Anybody here from Rhode Island?
I mean, in terms of size. But and for the U.S., you know, the Obama administration applauded this action. Now, down the line, it is almost certain that most states, and especially the biggest states, will face the same problem because they all have huge unfunded pension liabilities and health care liabilities that they're grossly understating. So you have liabilities, you have a stream of liabilities that you know you will have to pay. Constitutionally, in most states, you will have to pay them. And they're calculating their underfunding by discounting those liabilities at 8%. But they're risk-free real liabilities. They don't have the volatility of market returns. They're known in advance. And you know you have to pay them, and they're basically indexed. So the appropriate discount rate is, on the high side, would be like 2%. Now, if you discount at 2%, they are wildly underfunded. So almost surely they will not be able, somewhere down the line, states will be facing a situation where all their revenues will be going to paying health care and pension benefits, and they won't be able to provide any services without massive increases in taxation. And then what do? Will the rest of the population stand for that? If the Obama administration bails out California, will Texas attack California? will the states that manage their fiscal balance sheets pretty well really put up with bailing out the ones that refuse to do it or refuse to even face the problem? That's basically Greece, right? They never faced the problem, and the EU basically said, okay, don't face it for now.
Comments, David?
No, I mean, I'm not having any trouble with this guy. I mean, I think that's right. I think the
you moved to Texas from California, so I guess that, you know,
yeah, I think
voted with your feet.
I think it's an outrage that states have defined benefit plans. It's just not credible that they keep their liabilities in check. I think they ought to convert all the DP plans to defined contribution plans, so you know your costs. In a defined contribution plan, you get so much a year, and that's, and then it's the responsibility of the participant. I think that's the only credible way for states to go.
Okay. We have a great crowd here, and we have at least two microphones. So I'm delighted to open it up for questioning, and we've got, I just would ask you to migrate to one or the other microphone.
May I say something while they're going to the microphone?
Sure.
Going away to the mic. You know, it's really been a pleasure working with Gene. I mean, we, as you can see, it's the academic side is terrific, but it's been staggering to me to see how much help he's been every step along the way on non-investment related issues, the issues of running a firm, that that he has opinions about, which is tribute to him, and also the business school and the Chicago approach to business education, which is try to put an issue into a conceptual framework, tie it to some theory if you can, empirical evidence, of course, and come up with a conclusion. You know, somebody like Gene with no experience in industry can come in and be of huge value.
Well, it actually turns out that all of the workshops that I was sat through in which people talked about game theory and all that sort of stuff, you actually can see applications of it when you go out and look at various contracting problems that real firms face. So there were cases where I could really say, okay, well, this is what these are the problems of doing it this way, and these are the upside of doing it that way. Where, I mean, these simple models don't say everything, obviously, but they do have a little bit of insight to bring to bear on real business things. But he's being too kind to me. I mean, I don't know anything about business except what I learned from him, because I've never had a job. Well, a real job.
I will say that as the person who's fortunate enough to go out and talk to all these Chicago alumni, your approach, you know, it's unique in that it's in the setting, but it's not at all unique. It's what Chicago people do. I mean, the president of Domino's Pizza, why are they doing this thing where they basically said, our brand name stinks, we got to rebuild it. It's a very basic, you know, I'm sure they did some studies, they figured out their brand name stinks, and they got to rebuild it. So, anyways, questions.
Hi, I just, as Chicago faculty, I want to reassure Gene that we're teaching the students market efficiency the right way. So I do have two questions which are related. And one is about, so now that you're expanding Dimensional Fund Advisor, I was just curious whether you are thinking into investing in many other, there are many other risk factors that people use in the industry, like momentum, accruals, asset growth, there are all kinds of anomalies. So have you thought about investing into those anomalies and creating indexes for those? And the second question is, there's another way of sort of discipline investing which people use on Wall Street, which is the Black Lidman model. By the way, Bob Lidman is coming tomorrow to Gleacher.
Which model?
Bob Lidman, he's just retired from Goldman Sachs. So I'm just curious, that's where people invest in an index, but they also use their views to tilt away from the index. Have you thought about that kind of disciplined kind of active management, but still keeping some kind of index in mind?
Well, we don't do anything about any of these other anomalies. Basically, the asset allocation philosophy is value growth from a French three-factor model, and momentum we do nothing positive about. We just avoid it. So we don't buy stocks after they've fallen dramatically in price, and so that limits the selling a bit. But that almost takes place as a matter of course if you trade slowly. You basically avoid momentum. So that's one of the reasons why the small stock portfolios historically have beaten the benchmarks like the Russell 2000 is. The Russell 2000 gets killed by momentum because they take in a lot of stocks right after they've experienced large declines, and we trade slowly, so that gives means we don't get hit by that, and that contributes a lot to, that's what people now call the reconstitution effect to some extent. But the other things we haven't, I'm kind of suspicious of all that other stuff. I don't, lots of it, some of it has big steep T statistic and some of it doesn't. But there's a version of the mutual fund problem in that research. So how would I characterize behavioral finance empirical research? There's no theory there. They just go out and look for anomalies. Now, if you put yourself in the business of looking for anomalies, you're going to find them. But it's kind of like taking the cross-section of mutual funds and say, I'm just going to pull out the winners, and then I'm going to tell stories about those. You're not taking into account that there's a multiple comparisons problem and that you've really searched across the whole set of possible things that could be influencing prices and focused in on the ones that seem to work.
Yeah, nobody talks about the January effect anymore.
No, nobody talks about that anymore. Is it gone? Well, yeah. We never observed it in our portfolios, right?
Yeah, right.
Next question.
Yeah, Mr. Baum, I'm curious, why is it fair to look at the whole universe of managers? If you're looking at trying to evaluate skill in surgeons or lawyers or professional athletes, you wouldn't just take the entire universe, I imagine. So why, in portfolio managers, do you assume that everyone is equal and that people can't tell professional characteristics apart? You can't tell where they went to business school, like Chicago Booth, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you might, down the line, somebody might bring in more information about whether you can use manager backgrounds. People have tried to do research on that. I don't believe those results either. They tend to be very flimsy. But people have tried to identify whether characteristics of managers make a difference. And the results there are really weak. And the data aren't very good because managers that are successful don't stay on the job. They typically go and start their own funds if they've been successful. And now, going forward, you're not going to know because most fund families won't tell you anymore who the manager is. They don't want to advertise who does well and who does poorly, so they say team managed. You don't even get that information anymore. But, you know, anything that refines the test is always for the better.
Hi, I was just curious. I'm a first year. I noticed, I think, in the news, especially last week, like the market dropped by like 1,000 points, and then a few minutes later, it shot right up.
Right.
And I was just curious what your perspective is on that incident.
Yeah, that seems like a huge market microstructure problem to me of some sort. Some kind of trade triggered something. And they haven't figured it out yet, which is the frightening part.
Yeah, no, it's...
David, you had an analysis.
Right. You may know more than I did.
Well, what's frightening is that when events like last week happen, governments around the world always bring out the usual suspects. You know, they want to start blaming program trading, and then they go into, if that doesn't work, banks, blame the banks. And then if all else fails, they'll say those speculators. My guess is that you had, it was kind of dueling algorithms or something, you know, somebody on a computerized basis did some goofy things. Now, the reason that's important to think about is we have to defend market efficiency all the time. And market efficiency we talk about some of the things it does say. One of the things it doesn't say is that if you really do stupid things, you can easily hurt yourself. That's totally consistent with efficient markets. And one of the things we do in trading, and as Gene alluded to early on, we give our traders total flexibility. So if you see that if a trade's coming in and you can, if you want to sell Accenture, you have to sell it at 2 cents, you know, you have to ask yourself, is that reasonable? You know, or if a trade's coming across and P&G has been trading at 60 and all of a sudden there's a block available pops up at 39, you have to say, does that make sense? I mean, there's always room for human judgment. And I think when you see those really strange events, it's probably with institutions trading with themselves in that sense, I don't think it's a problem.
What's that term that you said when three planets line up?
Oh, yeah. Syzygy. I mean, there's in astronomy, there's called a term called syzygy. It's when, like, three planets are
odd things
up.
Happen.
But when that, according to astrologists, when that happens, you know, cats start sleeping with dogs or whatever, and you know, weird things happen. So I think what you have is a confluence of a lot of unlikely events that came together, and it was really institutions trading with each other. So I don't see why that's a problem. I mean, if institutions want to trade with each other and do stupid things, you know, I don't know if there's a proper role for government in trying to untangle that. People really cared about those trades, you can always put in limit orders.
Yeah.
We rarely come in and dump things in the market and say, I'm willing to sell this at any price. Just give me any bid that comes along, the best one that's available, I'll sell it at that. We use some judgment. We go, I don't want to sell it below this. If it's been trading at 60, you know, I'm not going to accept $39 as a trade.
I think that's an important point. You know, if you believe that this is something that happened, and maybe even you believe that there were people who did not self-protect and they got hurt, you still have to ask the question, does it make sense for the government to come in and say you have to stop certain types of trading because you know the government is going to mess it up? The optimal number of these kinds of strange events is not zero.
Yeah.
You have in probably almost all the courses you've taken here, if you see graphs, they're all continuous in the sense that you can trace a pencil over them without ever having to lift the pencil. In markets, real markets, there are gaps. How you deal with gaps is, you know, it's important. I mean, here again, efficient market buffs as we are, we give people the flexibility of a trading desk to decide if that's sensible or not.
So I can't remember who was next, but we'll get both of you. You're next.
So you mentioned how a small percentage of the population believes in efficient markets, so therefore a small percentage of the population is using passive management. So just wondering your thoughts on if it gained popularity and a much higher percentage of the population started using passive management and therefore a lower percentage was using active management, what you think would actually end up happening?
Well, I have this simple view of the world that says information that's available is basically costlessly available to everybody, and then everything else is basically infinitely costly to uncover. So it doesn't take very much in that kind of world to make markets efficient. Takes a little bit, but not very much. A little bit of active trading to do it. But the reality is, we're not very good at describing how much it takes. We're very good at testing whether prices, as they come to us, behave as if markets are efficient. We're not very good at saying how they got there.
But the second part, though, I won't let him off the hook so easily.
Yeah.
It's still, if active management did work in that case,
yeah.
It's still, you still have to ask the question, why would that person share any of it with you or me?
Yeah.
I mean,
but he was asking, I think he was asking the time-worn question of, would markets be efficient if you didn't have active investors? And the strict answer is no. But then the follow-up question is, how many of them do you need? Because what active managers do is they correct the mistakes of bad active managers. So you need the good ones to balance the bad ones, I suppose. So we shoot the bad ones, we'll need less active good ones. But the bad ones are as hard to identify as the good ones, so that's a tough job.
Yes.
Hi, first, thank you very much to three of you for being here today. I appreciate it. My question is kind of more of a personal for Professor Fama. Have you had students that have come in over the years that you've worked with and then brought into Dimensional? And then for the both of you, when you do hire people into Dimensional, what types of qualities or attributes are you looking for the traders and the portfolio managers, et cetera?
Well, I mean, we weren't bright, honest people that share our values. Is I don't know if Bonnie made it here tonight. The older I get, in addition to being talented, and in fact, this is at the end of the year, every year when we start talking about compensation, I say, you know, it's not enough to be productive around here. We want good people, because over the long haul, you want to have a little bit of fun as well. So we want talented people to get along.
How many Chicago graduates do we have?
Gosh, it's hard to say. In the investment area, I'm guessing maybe, a third to half of the portfolio managers.
Yeah. But remember, historically, Chicago students didn't want to come work for a passive manager.
Right? Yeah, right.
So it's not that they wouldn't hire them. I think we've recruited here forever, right?
Yeah.
Every year. But it was very difficult to get students interested. Current market might be a different situation.
Yes. Professor Fama, over the past 2 years or 3 years, there have been overvaluations and undervaluations of some assets or stories of such undervaluations, right, and undervaluations.
Stories of such, right.
It
he
seems
took my course, so he shouldn't use words like that. But
it seems that it's very hard to defend the story of that not being a story only. It seems that there is information that some of those assets were indeed under or overvalued. How can we explain to somebody that doesn't understand fully what efficient markets theory is, how those two parts of the story come together?
So, I don't know, somebody should write a book on 2020 hindsight, because that's what most of this is. So asset prices after the fact are always wrong, based on new stuff that comes out. So housing prices were too high based on the fact that a huge recession took place. They mightn't have been too high if it hadn't. But that's considered a market inefficiency. Every asset market fell when the recession came along, almost all by the same amount. Commodities markets fell almost all by the same amount. Was everything in the world overvalued? And then it fell. Well, if you read The Economist, that's basically what it comes down to. I have a bit of a problem saying that the world as a whole is overvalued. I have a bit of a problem with that. One market, maybe you can tell a story. I kind of doubt it, but I might listen about one market. But when you tell me the whole world is overvalued, every asset class, then I have a problem.
And what is the problem?
The problem is I have difficulty jibing that with some real economic story. Can everything be out of whack?
I also think you want to follow the money, you know, like particularly after the 2007-2009 decline, and the discussion of active management would come up and say, okay, well, if everything was overvalued, then who made lots of money on the decline? It looks like, you know, Paulson did, but yeah, other than that, it was so obvious that everything was overvalued.
Well, the hedge fund managers must have, right?
No.
That was a rhetorical
question. Yeah, right.
But I think Gene's point is a really, I mean, I've heard you say it before, it's a very important point. After the fact, all these prices are wrong.
Right, every day.
Every day. And when you're trying to, going back to the question, which I thought was a good one, how do you explain market efficiency? You know, we always look back and say, oh, that price was wrong, that price was... I mean, everybody says that. I mean, we all should say that.
I tell people, small stocks actually never lose money. They just crouch down really low sometimes, even spring higher.
Okay.
You don't think you're losing money.
There have been lots of studies. See, basically what you raised was a market timing issue. And there have been lots of studies of market timing. And the evidence there is even weaker than it is for stock picking. There don't seem to be people that can market time. So if there are these bubbles or over and undervaluations, people seem unable to identify them. Then what does that mean? If they're over or undervalued, I think that's after the fact. It says prices fell or they rose.
These are really good questions. Good. Keep going.
Professor Fama, I had a question about your research, but first I want to make sure I understand it correctly. Your research shows that before costs, the left and right tail are fat enough that we can reject the hypothesis that there is no skill.
Right.
So in other words, we're saying there is skill.
But both sides.
Yeah, so after adjusting for cost, that's when there's a shift to the left. And
right.
You're just, as an investor, you're just better off in passive management.
Right.
My question is, why can't someone look at that research and say, see, there is skill, so there are people who can consistently beat the market. So markets are not efficient. It's just that these people charge too much for their skill.
Yeah, that's fine. So if you went back to the first thing I ever wrote on market efficiency, I always say, I say this in my class about 40 times, students get bored hearing it, we talk about models. We call them models because they're not reality. They are models. They're approximations to the world. So this is a sense in which there is approximation. So you can uncover evidence of skill out there. It doesn't do investors any good, but you can uncover it. When you look at things before cost, you do see evidence of skill. That doesn't bother me at all. I mean, that goes back to the issue of somebody has to be making these markets efficient. It just isn't accruing to the benefit of investors. But as Ted pointed out, you really don't expect it to anyway. So
well, I think David did, but I think of it the same way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a human capital return, basically. Right.
Yeah. Let's keep going.
Hi.
So nobody would ever go to the extreme and say there can't be any skill out there because there has to be skill out there. Nobody would ever say that. Nobody would ever say markets are completely efficient. Nothing's ever completely anything. The scientific question is, are they efficient for your purposes? And for every practical purpose I've ever seen, the answer to that question is yes, especially for investors.
My question is not about finance. I would like to ask Mr. Booth and Professor Fama what they think the priorities for the school should be in the future, especially now that we are going to have a new dean and expectations are so high because Dean Snyder did such a wonderful job.
Well, I'll talk to that. David's made us financially quite well off, and Ted has made us intellectually quite well off. He's going to leave the school in incredibly strong shape, at least as far as the faculty is concerned, stronger shape than it's ever been in during my almost 50 years here. And that's an amazing accomplishment. He's established a rapport with the faculty, with the students, and especially with the alumni. I mean, by far the most successful dean with the alumni that we've ever had, which is incredibly important to bring all of these talented people back to become integral parts of the Chicago community. So I hope the next dean can do as well. If we do as well, I'd be happy. But that's the problem for the next generation. So.
Well,
I think that was, you have a shot at that question if you want it.
No. I don't want to touch it because I don't want to see Ted go, but, you know, that's cool.
All right, other questions? That took the kibosh out of everybody. Okay. Are you getting up to leave or ask a question?
Professor Fama knows who I am, so I don't. But, yeah, so I had a quick question about when an idea reaches the point where you feel like the empirical evidence justifies sort of bringing it into the philosophy at Dimensional. So, you know, in 93, you had the breakthrough right. around three-factor, and there was a body of evidence that you and Professor French brought to bear on that, you know, this is a new kind of model and view of the world. And, you know, earlier in answering one of the questions, you sort of dismissed a little bit some of the four-factor models and, you know, maybe some of the statistical support is weak. And so just trying to understand where what's that litmus test and when do you sort of have the sufficient confidence to
Well, okay, that's a good question. So if you look, you shouldn't overestimate how many different ideas got used. So basically, some of the work that I did on bonds in the 70s and 80s gets incorporated into their bond products. And then the major thrust of the equity products has been the three-factor model, domestically and around the world, and what, you know, the kind of the framework that that gives you thinking about asset allocation. The rest of it is kind of reacting to things like Enid brought up about other anomalies. So we examine the evidence, bring it in, try to simulate past results, see what they would look like if you put them together, and then see what that, if anything, that implies. So there's a lot of, you know, looking around the margins, and we have a crew of research people who are tooled up and ready to do these simulations all the time. That's all. That's basically what they do.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. The issue of momentum was an interesting one.
Yeah,
because you know, for years we had this outperformance. At first, we thought it was just random good luck, but then we studied it. Ken Friend spent a lot of time looking at it, and what we concluded, that, as Gene pointed out, was that a lot of our outperformance could be attributable to dealing with momentum, even though we didn't know it was there. And it was a byproduct of the way we traded, which was being patient. For those of you that haven't studied momentum, stocks that have fallen a lot have a tendency to underperform, and going forward, and those that have gone up a lot have a tendency to outperform. And there are different ways of measuring it. So by being a patient trader, we weren't buying small stocks just as they came into the universe, nor were we selling them immediately once they crossed a threshold. And inadvertently, that added a lot of money to what we were doing.
And conversely, the Russell 2000, the robots get hammered.
They get hammered, that because the index
momentum.
Yeah, they reconstitute it on a certain day, and they just take.
They tend to sell the ones that go up and buy the ones that went down.
That day. So this creates an interesting issue. But observe, it's consistent with market efficiency in that we weren't inducing trading. We weren't going out and purposely buying positive momentum stocks or selling negative momentum stocks. We were, just part of trading, dealing with it correctly. So once we understood the research and how it applied to us, see, we started the firm in 81, and Jagadish and Tittman, I think, was about the first one that came out mid-90s.
Right.
So we'd been doing this for a dozen years
or
so before there was even a hint of momentum.
Right.
But it is kind of cool then. We then have the academic research about momentum. We identify that's indeed what was contributing a lot to what we were doing, so we incorporated into our trading desk
more formally, right?
And formally, but we viewed it as a trading cost, is what Gene was getting at. It's not like we're all of a sudden an active manager and we're going to be trading on momentum, but so it's a nice blend of incorporating the research without violating our principles, and we're doing some of the other research on the real tiny, the micro cap companies with negative earnings. We're kind of backing off of those a bit now, based on the research as well. We're kind of Bayesians at heart. Sorry.
I think we've run out of time, but if you have a real quick question, pose it, and then I'll try to make sure we answer it quickly. You get the last question.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Professor Fama, you talked about market timing, and Professor Cochrane also talks about expected returns being forecast by dividend yield. Mm. So how do you conceal those?
Well, the expected return on the stock market, say, that's a price. It's a price for bearing the risk of holding stocks. And like any price, you expect it to vary through time. So there's some evidence that dividend yields pick up some of that variation. But there's lots of controversy about the statistics underlying that. So I firmly believe that expected returns vary through time. I just don't think we've come up with the variables that track it. track that variation in expected returns. Now, that's the kind of expected returns that you get fully consistent with market efficiency, in the sense that you're just saying that the equilibrium expected return that it takes to get people to hold risky securities changes through time. When people are well off, it tends to be low. When they're poor, it tends to be high. But we haven't been very good at identifying that variation. So that's kind of Ken French and I wrote one of the first papers on precisely this topic, on forecasting stock returns with the dividend yield. And it seems to be there, but the statistical reliability of it is kind of shaky.
Yeah, we were discussing his research in September of 87.
Right.
And Gene goes, well, you know, it seems like the expected returns on stocks are really low. I mean, market efficiency buff, he would never say the expected return is less than riskless assets. But so somebody said, well, what should we do? He goes, well, nothing. The variance around that point estimate is very large. So we didn't do anything. And, of course, in October of 87, we had the stock market crash. So that's one of those times where you kind of, well, you can't look back. It would never make sense for us to do timing. But.
No, because you know, the way, given the statistics, you know there must have been other periods when it went the other way. So that's what makes the thing so flimsy.
Yeah, I just got back from the Kentucky Derby. I was there with some friends, and my horse won. Now, the way I do, since I'm an efficient market buff, I didn't do any analysis. I only look at the names. And obviously, of the horses that were running, Super Saver, being in the investment business, Super Saver seemed like a natural horse to bet on. And it won. So now that created more problems than it was worth. And now everybody wants to know what my technique was.
Well, listen, thank you all, you know, for being here. Gene Fama really is one of these heroes of many people here, and represents the kind of guiding light for the faculty, and David, it's just been such a great friend of mine during my time. And I think what's really great about this discussion is what I think when I think about Stacy and how we've thought about the positioning of the school, it's just been so easy for us to think about Chicago having a unique spot in the business school world, where what's of interest to faculty is of interest to the students and the alumni. And what David talked about is the basic Chicago approach. You got frameworks and you got data and you have good decision making. It really works. And with that, I'll just say I wish you all the very best. And thank you for joining us. And thanks again to Gene Fama and David Booth.